content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello and season's greetings, everyone. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the December 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. Our theme this month has been the joys of Christmas, toys we treasured. We're going to get to three articles today. Hopefully we'll get through them all. The first one is this. These are, I think they're all under the title here, Toys We Treasured. At least we're going to start out with one that says that. And then this one says Bicycle, Freedom on Wheels. And there's a gentleman of 50 plus, let's say, because he has white hair and a scruffy little beard on his face, and he has got a big smile on his face. He's holding up a bicycle, which says Dogwood on the support beam, and he's obviously very happy that he gets to hold this bike. A Winston-Salem man has turned his childhood sense of adventure into a career that lets him share the gift of pedaling through life's ups and downs. Written by Morgan Sykes. The bicycle shop in David Johnson's suburban garage in Winston-Salem is a laboratory of painted tubes, workstands, and tools. Frames hang from the ceiling, and completed bikes draped in protective plastic coverings await pickup. A whiteboard lists all the orders on Johnson's 6 to 8 month waiting list, with notes on each client. It's clear that this 55-year-old bicycle maker loves every step in the process of turning tubes of steel into tailor-made, two-wheeled wonders. A bicycle is one of the most unique environments that you'll ever put yourself in, he says. You're the engine. You're the pilot. You're the passenger. You're the navigator. He pauses and chuckles. And you're hopefully enjoying yourself. If you're not happy, something's wrong. Johnson compares his craft, its emphasis on time, workmanship, and exacting standards geared for maximum joy, to that of creating the high-quality barbecue that North Carolina is famous for. That's what the signature iconography for his Dogwood Cycle Works, that's with an X at the end, brand, is: a rotund hog frolicking in front of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. Black outlines of the swine hide out in an inconspicuous nook on the frame, right behind the pedals. In this state, barbecue is a religion. It starts with an oink, he says. So this is my way of saying that this bicycle is handcrafted. It's my ode to North Carolina. The head badge, the metal logo on the tube at the front of the bicycle, is a stylized dogwood flower. Lest the message be unclear, the words Handicraft in North Carolina adorn each bike that rolls out of this shop. Like kids all over the country, Johnson always longed to wake up on Christmas morning and find a sparkling new bicycle under the tree. But a bike never materialized. Instead, his parents insisted that he get a paper route and buy one for himself. So beginning at age 13, he'd get up early on weekend mornings and set out on the sleepy, tree-lined streets of his neighborhood in Roanoke, Virginia, fantasizing about the day when two wheels could replace sneakers as his mode of transportation. He saved every penny he got until he could afford the bicycle of his dreams, a champagne gold 12-speed Ross Grand Tour. Then he took the money he'd earned to a local bike shop and plunked it on the counter. "I paid $181 and change for it," he says. The moment he threw his leg over the top tube, he pressed down on the pedal, and he knew that he'd discovered his destiny. "All of a sudden," he says, "I felt freedom, a sense of flight. It was like, yep, this is it." Newer and better bicycles followed him from middle school to high school. When he was a senior, rather than join his classmates for a boozy spring break vacation, Johnson planned a solo bicycle trip from Roanoke to Williamsburg. When he joined the Navy at 18, he spent his time off visiting bicycle shops and pedaling around the countryside. In Italy, he discovered racing culture. He explored Sicily, and later he rode his bike around Hawaii. After returning stateside for art school at Virginia Western Community College, Johnson eventually pursued his career in welding that brought him to an aviation maintenance company in North Carolina. In his spare time, he continued to ride. And then the recession hit in the late 2000s. Johnson was laid off. He knew that he wanted a change. "I was trying desperately to find something," Johnson said. "I've never been an inside-the-box kind of guy." While working in aviation, he'd gained experience welding the same kinds of materials that are used in bicycle making. His art school training grounded him in design, and his obsession with bikes had always simmered beneath everything that he did. He didn't like working for other people anyway, so finally in 2010, he cashed out his 401k. "I went, you know what? I'm going to be the man." So I started frame building. In the earliest days of his business, Johnson recruited bike-savvy friends to help test the frames, telling them to be unrelenting. "I want you to beat this thing with an inch of his life and see what it does," he said to his buddies. He hoped that the frames would break, he says, so that he could learn from the failures that what worked and what didn't. He named his nascent enterprise Dogwood Cycle Works for the clusters of snow-white flowers that bloomed outside his childhood bedroom window. "As a kid, when I started seeing those things pop out, spring was here," he says. "It was time to go outside." It didn't hurt that the dogwood was the official flower of both his home and adopted states. Through all the changes and uncertainty in Johnson's life, he kept pedaling. There was the social ride with the like-minded crazies who took the 100-plus-mile round trip from Greensboro to Chapel Hill. 5.5 hours of smack-talking and cruising with friends. Another memorable journey involved dropping off the Blue Ridge Parkway and savoring the twisting roads, the foliage, the wafting smokes from campfires, and the tempting scents of barbecue cooking. He braved North Carolina's humid summers and freezing winters. The miles logged, the sweat, the elbow-to-elbow competition of jostling around corners and jockeying for position with other riders aiming to podium, all of it toughened him up. "As a cyclist, you learn to live in pain," he says. Maybe that's part of the big-picture lesson. His Buddha-like nature, when encountering challenges on the road, became a metaphor for his life out of the saddle. Mountains, he believes, have to be climbed before they can be descended. "You're paying in pain to get the exhilaration and pleasure of going down," he says. "You must pay the bill in order to reap the benefits." standing in his shop, surrounded by creations that are equally as impressive for their artful beauty as for their superior construction and technical precision, Johnson knows that he literally built his livelihood one bicycle journey at a time. Bikes have given him something, maybe everything, to live for. There are friends, there are experiences, and there's exhilaration, he says, and then pauses to reflect on his decades of adventure and a business that allows him to empower others to seek the same in their own lives. Bicycles, he says, return you with amazing gifts. Looking back on his long ride from penny-pitching paperboy to welder to bicycle maker, he now appreciates his parents' decision not to give him a bicycle for Christmas. When he finally bought that 12-speed Ross Grand Tour with the coins that he'd saved delivering newspapers, he remembers feeling a sense of pride. I earned it all on my own, he says. I paid for it. It was mine. Today, when Johnson encounters bumps along the road, he leans into them literally and metaphorically and just keeps pedaling. My happy place is on top of a bicycle, he says. I get rid of all the anger, hate, frustration, and tension. That's my therapy. That's my religion. If you're interested in Dogwood Cycle Works, you can reach them at dogwoodcycleworks.com. And now, under Toys We Treasured, Dollhouse, Gingerbread Dreams. There's more to Kernersville than most famous home, more to Kernerville's most famous home than meets the eye. Filled with nooks, trap doors, and a tiny theater, Corners Folly, and that's spelled with a K and an O with a double dot. Is that called an umlaut? Over it. Corners Folly is a Victorian homage to the great power of imagination. Written by Susan Stafford Kelly. When the Barbie dream house from Santa proved too small for Barbie's growing family, my sister and I improvised, creating a sprawling 8-room ranch house with grocery store boxes that we wallpapered with wrapping paper and carpeted with rug scraps. 30 years later, my daughter's dollhouse was called Polly Pocket, and it fits in her palm. The point being that dollhouses come in every shape and size, including a human-sized one in Kernersville with 6,000 square feet, 7 levels, 22 rooms, and 15 fireplaces. This is no plantation or mansion or estate or manor. It's a folly, Corners Folly. Says so right there in the many penny tiles on the porch that took a craftsman 5 years to lay by hand. In 1878, when Julius Gilmer Jewell Corner began building his bachelor home, folly was a trendy word for perceived idiocy, like Seward's folly, as the Purchase of Alaska was sometimes called. Jewell likely knew better, that in architecture, a folly is a building constructed primarily for decoration. So he was proud rather than insulted when a cousin dubbed his house Corner's Folly. Jewell's grandfather, Joseph Kerner, from Germany's Black Forest region, had arrived in America in 1785. He settled in what would become Kernersville a few years later. Jewell was born in 1851, studied art and design at schools in Indiana and Philadelphia, and once his home was finished in 1880, opened his Reuben Rink Decorating and House Furnishing Company. His big break came via Bull Durham Tobacco from W.T. Blackwell and Company. In Durham, for whom he was hired to paint the life-size snorting bull logo on barns, buildings, and boulders all over the South. And eventually the U.S. Bull Durham became a household name. And Jewel ran with it, signing each logo with Reuben Rink. Corner's Folly became a catalog house, a living advertisement for his decorating and furniture business. Or as operations and programs manager Susanna Ritz puts it now, the Victorian IKEA. And what an ad it was. The man never met a mantelpiece he didn't think could be fancier. I'll take that, that, and that one. And you can imagine a customer listing while perusing the acanthus leaves, beading, egg and dart molding, floral and mythological motifs, half corbels, and Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian classical columns mishmashed and stacked from the mantel to the 15-foot ceilings of the entrance hall. Never mind the jewel was only 5 feet. Six, once you clear the very low entrance, a life-size, paper dollish cutout of Jewel stands ready to greet you. Not a fan of the dining room's heavy, huge, dark Victorian-style buffet and china cabinet, designed by Jewel and likely made down the road in High Point? Pass right on through to the breakfast room, featuring what's believed to be the state's first skylight in a private home, and no doubt once filled with the houseplants that Victorians craved. Squeeze through what Ritz playfully calls the diet door, turn sideways for best results, and head for the smoking room, done up in unexpected peaches and yellows, with tile to the windows and an outdoor pump 10 feet away, lest a cigar ember go disastrously astray. Here, as in every room in Corner's Folly, it's advisable to look up. Ceilings are adorned with elaborate medallions and murals. Not everyone's wife was like Polly Alice Corner, willing to have customers wander through the first-floor master bedroom. But how else to test the velvet throne chairs that Jewel designed, or the pivoting window in the dressing room that allowed Polly Alice to look into the playrooms, one each, naturally, for daughter Dory and son Gilmer, whose ceilings barely scrape 5 feet because, well, children are short. Nooks and niches, secret doorways and hidden passageways abound. The kissing closet is shallow enough only for standing, seated necking not permitted, in an otherwise grand ballroom-sized reception hall, decked out in the original mirrored walls and painted and plastered in golds and ivories like gilded meringue. Here's the room that more than any other underscores Jewel's clear attitude that less is not more. Less is a bore. The room is also home to what Corner's Folly experts used to call the weird thing, a low upholstered wooden cart that Jewel designed, movable coffee table, practice stage for charades or plays, posing table for portraits. Finally, they figured out that it was a station for tailoring clothes. People would stand on the elevated platform to make sure their clothes were fitted correctly. Overserved or introverted guests could sneak through an unobtrusive door to the long room just for a break. Just around the corner, a hidden staircase, dubbed the Scary Stairs, due to their steep ladder-like risers, offers another escape. Rightly so, in this playhouse, Dory's room, decorated in that dusty rose color so favored in the era, is home to Medora, Dory's namesake doll, who leaves the Folly every few months to get her hair done and her wardrobe updated by Dory's granddaughter. The dressing room is situated directly above the kitchen, vented, to allow its occupant to enjoy the stove's heat and to guess what's cooking for dinner. Remember, as you go, that Jewel was perpetually tinkering, updating, renovating, converting, which explains the arched windows in the library where horses stuck their heads through in the room's former life as a stable. Nothing, however, prepares you for the theater on the uppermost floor, the literal crown jewel of the Folly. The steep pitch of the gabled roof houses a stage, an orchestra pit, and enough room for an audience of 80. The Corner family were all musical, and Polly Alice loved dramatic presentations, inviting the Kernersville citizenry. There's even a green room just behind the Half Moon stage where one awaited cues. Possibly the only architectural feature that Jewel didn't include in the Folly was a turret, and by golly, he got his proscenium. From the theater's window, you can see what was surely the most elaborate outhouse in the land, the Privy, a four-seat, electrified mini-Folly. Wallpaper that mimics elephant hide, lion faces on lintels, water sprites on hearth tiles. A sense of playful experimentation is reflected in every room of this grown-up dollhouse. Showpiece, sandbox, lab. For those of us who don't know the difference between a pillar and a pilaster, how best to describe Corner's Folly? We don't have the vocabulary for all of it, Ritz admits. It's a perfect confluence of Gothic, German, Victorian, and the American yen for the next new thing. Like his home, Jewel Corner himself defies pigeonholing. Engineer, artist, designer, advertiser, salesman, eccentric, perfectionist. Why do a little when you can overdo? Which means that no one should be surprised to learn that Jewel bought a farm full of cedar trees to make certain that each of his cedar shingles was identical, or that he reverted to the Americanized spelling of his last name from Kerner to the German Corner. That two-dot umlaut fancies up a plain old O all day long. Corner's Folly is at 413 South Main Street in Kernersville. Cornersfolly.org. Remember that corner is spelled with a K. And now, toys we treasured, Matchbox cars. We'll read as much of this as we can. Joyrides. In a private showroom in Watauga County, an early trailblazer in auto online sales collects life-size versions of the toy cars of Christmas's past, written by Brian Mims. Chip Perry, a child of the Eisenhower era who remembers when cars had wings, stands on the balcony of his personal auto showroom in Blowing Rock and feels the urge to pinch himself. Often, when he gazes across this airy room, shiny cars parked side by side on the faux wood porcelain floor, he feels that he's in a dream. Might as well cue the sugar plums, because this can't be for real. And yet, here they are, real cars, as pristine and lustrous as new-fallen show. An Adria blue 1951 Porsche, a rosette green 1952 Porsche 356 American Roadster, an opalescent bronze 1962 Jaguar. When he beholds all these wheeled wonders, the 68-year-old Perry feels like a kid on Christmas morning. Every time, he says, to be able to enjoy these kind of cars in this kind of place. Well, it's a wonderful life. The 13,000-square-foot car barn, as Perry calls it, is about as jaw-dropping as the views from the nearby Blue Ridge Parkway. The exterior, with its natural stone and gray cedar, blends well with the traditional architecture in this mountain town. The cupolas and gambrel roof give it the look of a fancied-up barn, the kind that some people would turn into a venue for weddings and special events. It's anything but a home for livestock. A comfy living room for both car and driver is more like it. Perry's wife, Monica, insisted that it have a homey feel for entertaining guests. While the showroom is not open to the public, the Perrys do host the occasional soiree here to raise money for community organizations. Five chandeliers light this barn, which includes alcoves with sofas and coffee tables. It has a bar with wine and martini glasses at the ready, glinting like chrome. It has a study with shelves weighed down by car and golf books and magazines. Lots of people like to sit on the furniture, sip their drinks, and just look at the cars, says Perry, who's dressed casually in a blue V-neck sweater and ball cap. Two Boston Terriers, Mousy and Vivi, wander the floor and sometimes jump onto a car seat. The Car Barn, built by Lenora-based Jerome Clark Construction and completed in 2018, shelters more than two dozen automobiles. It has air conditioning and heat because these motorized beauties need all the pampering they can get, leaving them in a garage immersed in humidity and subject to extreme temperatures would cause them to deteriorate. The cars are lined up diagonally in two rows, their grills pointed toward the door, ready to rev and roll. My dream when we started this was to have a place where we could put my cars and drive out without having to move any of the other cars, Perry says. So you jump in and go. And go he does. At least once a month, Perry hops into the driver's seat of each car and zips along U.S. Highway 221, a two-lane that burrows and switchbacks through hard woods and white pines, southwest Grandfather Mountain. Gripping the wheel, he leans into each hairpin turn, feels the side force against his body, feels the wind against his face, feels the melding of man and machine on the open road. There's a reason why these cars capture the imagination, he says. The entire driving experience is analog, not digital. It's very much more connected to the car and the road. Perry is quick to point out that while he doesn't drive recklessly, he does give his cars a good workout. I call it spirited driving, he says. Sports cars are made to handle well in the curves. Once he reaches Grandfather Mountain, he turns around and motors back home on the Blue Ridge Parkway. To cruise its high elevation curves is to experience spirited driving at its scenic best. Behind the wheel of a 1959 Porsche 356A Carrera Coupe or a 1956 Austin Healey 110M, Perry breezes along the Lynn Cove Viaduct, a photogenic bridge that weaves among the boulders and treetops like a concrete garland. He stops at any number of overlooks to take pictures of his cars against the backdrop of fir-topped ridges and hemlock-shaved shade coves. I'm going to jump to the end. It says, cars aren't what they used to be. These days, they're so high-tech, so automated, so insulated from the outside world. Quiet and luxurious are selling points. The act of driving has lost much of its thrill. Modern cars, Perry says, just don't require the kind of attention and skill that older cars require. Brian Mims is a reporter from WRAL in Raleigh. From 2012, he was named the Television News Reporter of the Year. And he wrote this article, and he must have got to see those cars that you and I can't readily see. Well, that's about all the time we have for this episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And happy holidays!